news.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network, and in Oregon government, there is nothing the government does that it can't whitewash to make a problem simply go away when it becomes inconvenient for those in charge. And these days, and for the last several decades, you don't have to ask who's in charge. The Democrats run all five of the state's statewide elected offices. They run both chambers of the legislature. They own all the judges, and they own a disturbing number of the prosecutors. So when a problem shows up, you simply have to say, what's the best way to whitewash this thing out of existence, even when it's something that actually breaks the law? I'll get into the details of the latest whitewash of the Kotek administration. Oh, and by the way, the Ellen Rosenblum administration, even though she's leaving as attorney general, I guess she's planning to do as much damage as she can before she goes out the door. But let me get to that in just a moment. First, welcome to Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network, celebrating at the end of this year 25 years of serving the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And if you want to jump into that conversation, you are always welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you happen to be a naysayer, we love naysayers, as you can tell. You just have to come prepared. I mean, come prepared to make your point expeditiously and then stick around for a few questions where I can get some clarification on what you're trying to argue. If you want to do that, it's 866-439-5277. You can send emails easily to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote on our poll on X. Used to be Twitter. Now it's X. You may have heard the occupation of a major faculty building at Portland State University, and they've been having problems at University of Washington as well. In fact, the University of Washington now pleads that its crews cannot keep covering up the graffiti as fast as the pro-Palestinian terrorist groups are putting it up on campus. Every time it gets cleaned up, according to our friend Jay Cho, the journalist in Seattle, more of it shows up the very next day. Now, I would suggest that the proper solution to that problem is zip cuffs and a ride to the police station. But the University of Washington can't do that. I mean, they have to let the terrorism promoters stay occupying the campus and doing it damage. But we now know the estimated tab for the damage that was done at Portland State University at the Miller Library. Remember, all of this is owned by the public, meaning it's owned by the people of the state of Oregon. PSU is a publicly funded, publicly owned institution. And the folks who are in charge of it, I mean, that is such a corrupt bunch at this point. Ann Cudd, who's outstanding in her field as PSU president, she stands there and wrings her hands and clutches her pearls and says, oh, people have taken over one of our buildings. What should I do? And every common sense voice in the neighborhood says, call the cops. Have those people arrested. Oh, no, I don't want to do that. I mean, they're there just expressing their free speech rights and all that. Oh, while they're doing, and here's the estimate, $750,000 to $875,000 in damage to something that all of the people of the state of Oregon have bought and paid for and own and pay to operate. Tens of millions of your dollars, tax dollars, go to operate PSU. And of course, you know that as a taxpayer, you're probably going to end up paying the biggest part of the tuition bill, especially for all those little darlings who decided to get one of those left-handed underwater basket weaving degrees that doesn't really lead to much except a job pouring coffee. The estimate is $750,000 to $875,000 in repairs. So I thought it'd be appropriate in our poll on X today to ask this. Should a judge order the people who occupied the college campuses to pay the bill? Now, I think that's common sense. You do that much damage, fine. Those of you who got caught and cited and identified by the cops, let the judge assign each one of those people an equal amount of the damage. Might even get it down to, I don't know, $20,000 or $30,000 each. And if you can't pay it off out of your checking account, I'm guessing that most of these people are largely judgment proof. That is, they don't have any money. Then fine. Let them pay it off over time. Kind of like the kid who set fire to the gorge a few years ago with fireworks. He's paying off his debt. Now, it may take a long time, but he's vowed that he's going to pay that debt off. In fact, one of these days, I'm going to try to get an interview with that young man because I don't admire what he did to the gorge. I don't admire throwing the fireworks into a dry gulch during summertime and having it set off a fire. But to his credit, he's actually working to pay the bill. So should a judge order the occupiers who damage college campuses, whether it's PSU or UW, pay the bill? And if you're not going to do that, if you're not going to demand that they pay the bill, then why should the taxpayers pay the bill? If you know some of the people responsible, and I guess you could invite them to name any of the other people who were involved in that damage, then you pay the bill. In any case, glad to get your phone calls and your emails. Let me tell you about the latest whitewash from the state of Oregon. It was more than a year ago that we found out that some of the top officials at the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission, those both working in the staff, the executive director, and others, they decided to use their public positions for personal benefit. That is, they wanted certain bottles of booze that you couldn't ordinarily set your hands on most of the time and be able to get one of those bottles. Pappy Van Winkle is a famous example of the bourbon that some of these jokers decided to have set aside. So they told the staff, these are so-called public servants who work for a public agency, supposedly to benefit the public. They said, hey, set aside a case or two of that for me or my friends, and we'll give it away as gifts, or maybe I'll buy it and take it home and drink it myself. That's what they did. Now, Oregon law, like most states, is very, very clear on this. It says if you use your public position for personal gain, you've violated the law. I mean, John Kitzhaber, the former governor of Oregon, had to resign his office because his nitwit grifter girlfriend, Sylvia Hayes, was out peddling influence in exchange for cash. I mean, she scored about $200,000, had to pay about a $50,000 fine. Sounds like a money-making opportunity to me. You make $200,000 illegally, and then you pay a $50,000 fine, still a very fine net profit, but you unfortunately cost your boyfriend his job. And so John Kitzhaber he only showed his face publicly just a little bit of time recently. So they turned this over to the Attorney General, Ellen Rosenblum, who's about to exit the office anyway. I'm sure she doesn't want to rock the boat. Guess what? They say that they have determined they are unable to make the case, even though they have the Liquor Commission's records. They have the warehouse records where all the liquor in the state of Oregon, by law, must go through that warehouse to end up on a store in front of any customer. And they say, we have the bank records, we have the credit card records, we have the records of the stores that sold the booze, but we were, quote, unable to discover the identity of the individual who made the subsequent purchase. Can you say whitewash? Because that's exactly what she did. She whitewashed this to make it away, go away. And by the way, all six of the OLCC managers at the center of the investigation simply said, we're not talking. Omerta. Great. Just keep that silence. That's how criminal activity goes. It's a Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. I'm going to talk about Washington State's three famous Bobs. Only one is still running for office, and that's coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network. I've been talking about...
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
Try that in a small sense. That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
If you think that Democrats are shy about engaging in election interference, just check out what wannabe Governor Bob Ferguson did yesterday. The Washington Attorney General vastly overstated an election law to intimidate two citizens who had the temerity to run against AG Bob. Ferguson held a news conference to threaten the other two Bob Fergusons with prosecution if they didn't drop out by 5 p.m. last night. Now, Washington State does have a law. And by the way, I did my due diligence. I read through it carefully. It forbids candidates using a fake name. The other two Bobs didn't do that. Their real names are Bob Ferguson. It forbids using a name that's real, like Donald Trump, but is not yours, like Donald Trump. The other two Bobs didn't do that either. It forbids using your real name if your intent is to, quote, confuse voters by capitalizing on the public reputation of a candidate who's already filed. That's the only part of the law that even comes close, and even then, I'd put it to a jury. Can you imagine Attorney General Bob taking the other two Fergusons to court and then asking a jury to send them to prison for running under their real names? And then imagine AG Bob proving that the other two Bob Fergusons intended to get an advantage by claiming a slice of AG Bob's sleazy reputation. The other two Bobs dropped out of the race last night, so we'll never know. But now voters know that Joe Biden and his criminal cronies are not the only ones who see threatening opponents with prison time as a prescription for their own electoral dysfunction. And by the way, I want to point something out that just happened today. Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House, showed up in New York City along with a few other Republicans to support Donald Trump in his trial in New York City. And the White House came out, was asked to respond to that, and Karine Jean-Pierre has now confirmed that the Trump trial in New York City, as she put it, is part of the 2024 elections. Really? She's admitting that it's a political prosecution. Imagine that. Now, our question of the day from Kevin Stair to the Oregon Firearms Federation. Lars, could we offer voters a choice of no when judges run for election or re-election? He heard my commentary yesterday about the giant scam in which voters virtually never get a chance to choose judges. They are always appointed and then run for re-election. And as sitting judges, they are very, very rarely ever challenged, because if you challenge a sitting judge and you're a lawyer and you lose, and that will happen most of the time, you are toast as a lawyer. So here's what he said. A supporter made a suggestion to me. I'm shopping it around. It'd be a tough climb as either a ballot measure or legislation, but promoting it could make a point. He suggested that any time a judge runs unopposed, that an option on the ballot would be no, meaning there would have to be another election with more than one candidate. We've known the system is rigged for years. Having a patriotic lawmaker propose it would, if nothing else, put the Democrats on record as opposing that choice. Signed, Kevin at the Oregon Firearms Federation. I'd add to that this idea. If a judge, for anything other than a solid medical reason, does not fulfill that judge's promise to the voters to serve out his entire six-year term. So if he gets cancer or heart attack, okay, fine, he can quit and be replaced. Other than that, if a judge quits midterm, that seat should sit empty until the voters choose the next occupant of that judicial position. Make that the law as well. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I want to give today's Daily Grill collectively to both the pro-Palestinian terrorist occupiers and to the university administration at both PSU and UW for not immediately tagging those responsible to pay the costs of all these repairs instead of handing the bill to the taxpayers. Shame on the administration at UW. Shame on PSU President Ann Kutt. Owen writes in with today's best email, but you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. And he makes a fairly good case. He says, Lars, as you well know, Oregon has a governor who's lost her way. That's Tina Kotek. The employment division has been a wreck for years. Adult and family services have failed our kids through incompetence and lack of accountability. ODOT can't even manage its own budget. The state's been in a competency crisis without any meaningful plan for reform. Our education system is crumbling due to woke agendas and lack of leadership. Oregon ranks number 46 among all states. The Oregon Department of Corrections has been in flux for a long time. Coffee Creek is the best example. Oregon just rated among the 10 top states for the worst crime. Oregon lacks any comprehensive plan to address employee workplace turnover and work conditions. I could go on, but this is the tip of the iceberg. So, with all this happening, Tina Kotek can only focus on having her wife mess up the office of the governor and push her crazy agendas. She spends our money on ill-planned, unaffordable, and homeless issues. She seems to think she has dictatorial powers from on high. The most unpopular governor in this nation. Love your show. Have a good one. Signed, Owen Herzberg. Owen, thanks very much for that. Let me go to the phones now. And if you want to join the conversation, it's 866-439-5277. First, let's go to Chuck. Hey, Chuck, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
I want to talk about Turd Ferguson saying they're trying to intimidate people, getting them off the ballot. I mean, yep. What better way to tell everybody that you're an authoritarian tyrant?
It's a great way to do it. It gives you a hint of what he'd be like as governor.
Well, I don't know where to go. If we have Donald Trump get elected and we got a fascist dictator in there and an authoritarian tyrant up in Olympia,
hold on. I'm not Trump sure where to is go. A fascist? Can you tell me?
I don't know, you know, I'm
a Trump supporter. I suppose you're not. But Chuck, can you tell me one thing that benefited Donald Trump personally? Because fascism is all about serving the state as opposed to things Trump did to make all of us. I know what a fascist is. Fascism is serving the interests of the state first and the interests of the individual last. And for some reason, Chuck decided to give up the ghost. Sorry about that, Chuck. Better get a new Obama phone. Let's go to Buster. Hey, Buster, welcome to the program, and thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network.
Something that the voters need to understand, and we talk about these punks and the vandals and rioters that, whether they're occupying a university building and vandalizing it, is that the Portland Democrats passed the mugshot bill back in 22 that suppressed mugshots so they could protect their Antifa supporters and others who get arrested.
Others.
And they said, well, it ruins their lives, but, you know, don't engage in behavior if you don't want to be arrested and your mugshot out there. So, again, the Democrats are protecting their political allies, those who vandalize and create disruption.
I agree with you because, Buster, for years as a reporter, especially in TV, we'd go down and get mugshots all the time. I don't see that there's any problem with saying to the public, this man or this woman has been arrested for this crime. And as long as you do it accurately, what's the problem? Do you know at the time they passed that mugshot ban, their biggest objection was that a large number of the mugshots were of people of color? And they said it's really inconvenient in politically correct Oregon to have so many people pictured who are people of color, brown or black. They didn't like it. They passed a law against it. They keep the public in the dark to the benefit of the criminals. And that makes no sense at all. Buster, thanks for the call. Back in just a moment. You're listening to a Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Lots of folks worry about their firearms, but Lars doesn't have to worry about Biden taking his guns. He stores them upstairs. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Big iron on his heel.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's not a pleasure to know that there are going to be more hundreds, maybe even thousands of people die in the Pacific Northwest because of fentanyl. Because last year's death numbers were north of 1,000 in Washington State, I think it was 2,000, and in Oregon, north of 1,000. About 1,200 people died, but now we're hearing of the deaths of children and even babies. And I thought this would be a good time to talk to Spokane County Sheriff John Knowles, who joins me now. Sheriff, welcome back.
Hey, thank you for having me today. It's my pleasure.
Well, we were told by lawmakers in both Salem and in Olympia, you're more concerned with Olympia, of course, but, well, we fixed the problem. We made it back to a minor crime to have these drugs on hand. Is this doing any good at this point?
I would say that the impact on drug use has been minimal, marginal at best. And this is coming from a sheriff who was supportive of it becoming a gross misdemeanor, but only because I think we need to enact penalties at the gross misdemeanor level that actually deter people. And we haven't done that. That is not in place right now. I think that's where the work with the legislature has to go next.
I'll play the devil's advocate for a moment, although I agree with you, Sheriff Knowles. But if you say, well, it needs some time to take effect, it needs time for the word to get around to the meth heads and the dealers and everything else that we're now it's a gross misdemeanor. Is there any likelihood that it's going to become better in a few months, or maybe next year? Or is this about all we're going to get out of the so-called fix that came out of Olympia?
Yeah, I think we've seen what we're going to get out of it right now. Like I said, I think we are already holding people accountable. I have directed my staff to book everyone they catch for that gross misdemeanor, but our jail capacity doesn't allow us to hold them. I think right now the public doesn't know if you get arrested for a gross misdemeanor. I mean, people can plead to that gross misdemeanor and receive, just probation or receive some kind of lower release level. There's really nothing happening to these people to motivate them to take part in treatment, to stop, using drugs. We need to get some sentencing in place that's going to actually motivate people to change their behavior. And it doesn't exist now. And I don't even know if anybody's talking about it right now at the state legislative level.
Do you think that's what they intended? I mean, what I mean by that is the folks on the left, the Democrats for the most part, said, we don't want to make it a crime at all. We want it to be a ticket like it is or was in Oregon. So now Oregon's made it a minor crime, misdemeanor crime. Washington State's done the same. They said, see, we can now say we've fixed the problem for now. They get past the November election before anybody says, hey, nothing much changed. The death numbers are going to be nearly the same for 2024 as they were for 23. Was that their intention, just to try to take it off the radar for a while?
I think for some of them, sure. I think there were a few moderates who kind of understood that something has to be done, like they have some basic understanding of human nature, but they're all kind of glossing over what most of us who understand addiction, who understand human nature, that people are going to continue to use drugs until we give them an alternative that is less attractive. More attractive.
More attractive.
We make continuing to use drug less attractive than it is. And it doesn't exist right now. With the state of the law and the state of the criminal justice system, the state of our court systems, we are doing zero to motivate people to change their behavior. And we're certainly not investing in treatment programs once we do get their cycle of addiction interrupted. So it's sad to say they did something that they could run up the flagpole and say, look, we did something, and I applaud it, but the applause stops the next day saying, okay, now what are we going to do to really change behavior?
Okay, so you asked for a crowbar and they delivered you a toothpick and you're saying it's not working. Have you figured out any workarounds where you can direct your deputies to go after this problem with what's on the books? Are there any innovations maybe you could suggest where you can use, work within the law, but figure out a way to go after this problem and give the addicts and the dealers some reason to stop what they're doing?
Yeah. So on the addict side, like I said, we're at least booking them to at least interrupt that cycle. We do have, information we can give them. Now on the dealer side, I have no quarter for dealers. I think we need to be far harder on drug traffickers than we are at both the state level and the local level. I am a huge proponent, particularly where the fentanyl epidemic is concerned, of minimum mandatory sentences. They do work. We can put minimum mandatory sentences in place that aren't, racially, disproportionate. We can just say, listen, if you're caught with more than 10,000 fentanyl pills, you're going to do 10 years in prison. And, I think the federal government should go even farther. Let's just make fentanyl unattractive to even traffic in, because it's killing people. And I think, honestly, fentanyl dealers, they're murdering our citizens. 10 years is way too light.
I'd agree with you. Now, you get along well. There is a U.S. Attorney's Office in Spokane. Am I right in remembering that?
Correct. Yeah, with the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Washington.
Right. And so in that case, do you get along well enough? I mean, I know they're working for the Joe Biden Justice Department, and there may be a downside to that. But can you get the U.S. Attorney to go after some of these? Because I'm noticing most of the bigger drug prosecutions in Oregon are not coming out of Portland Police. They're not coming out of Multnomah County Sheriff or Lane County Sheriff. They're coming out of the U.S. Attorney's Office. Is the U.S. Attorney's Office at least willing to go after this stuff? Because it does have such terrible, deadly consequences.
Yes, we have a great relationship with our U.S. Attorney, Vanessa Waldrop, here. She is very proactive in narcotics investigations and also controlled substance homicides. However, like she has a boss, ultimately, through the Department of Justice, and they put out a memo a long time ago at the beginning of the Biden administration talking about how they wanted to deal out and plead out different levels of drug crimes and drug dealing crimes, you know, in an effort to reduce, you know, disparity and things like that. I don't believe that's our particular U.S. attorney's approach, but that's something that's sent out through all DOJ. And
now, Sheriff, I got to ask you, though, let's translate this. When you use the word disparity, what the problem is, Merrick Garland, the attorney general, is telling his U.S. attorneys, we don't want as many black and brown people locked up. That's how that translates, isn't it?
Yeah, correct. And it leads back to when, you know, there was this belief that we were unjustly incarcerating people of color based on the crack cocaine minimum mandatory sentencing guidelines. And again, remember, it's a math problem. They're not saying that people didn't commit crimes. They're just saying they shouldn't have been incarcerated. And we could debate about the moral merits of that. But at the end of the day, we need to hold drug dealers accountable. And the policies that they're enacting at the federal level are taking accountability out of the system. And mind you, the state of Washington did that decades ago. I mean, they stopped holding people accountable in meaningful ways for trafficking narcotics, you know, back in 2004, 2005.
Ouch. Last question, and I have a feeling it ties back to drugs. Why are we seeing such a major spike in traffic deaths in the Evergreen State?
I think there's two things. And right, nothing, when you see large spikes like this, it's never one thing. I think it's where we were with the pursuit law. I think it's the addition of legalized marijuana. And I also think we have far fewer cops on the streets writing tickets than we have had in a long time. You know, just to give you an example, when I was working in the traffic unit back in 2003, we had 23 people working just traffic in the Spokane County Sheriff's Office, arresting DUIs, writing speeding tickets. To this day, right now, I have 7 in my agency now because of our staffing issues.
From 23 to 7. Sheriff Knowles, I'll look forward to our next conversation. At least we got somebody out doing the job, and we appreciate you coming on. Thank you, sir.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
That is Sheriff John Knowles from Spokane County. There you got it. And you know what to tell your state lawmakers if you want the problem fixed. Otherwise, order a gross of body bags right now. You've got the Lawrence Larson Show.
The 40th President of the United States always knew where to put the blame.
You have blamed mistakes of the past, and you blame the Congress. Does any of the blame belong to you?
Yes, because for many years I was a Democrat.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program and the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest for the past quarter century or so. The poll on X today, should a judge order the occupiers who damage college campuses to pay the bill? And I'm talking about UW, I'm talking about PSU, about all the college campuses that have been destroyed or damaged, not destroyed. The University of Washington says its crews can't even keep up with all the vandalism, most of it graffiti. They say every time it gets cleaned up, more of it shows up the next day, and maybe they should start arresting some of the people who do it, put them in front of a judge, and tell the judge to order them to pay damages. At PSU, the Miller Library, the bill estimate now to fix all the damage, $750,000 to $875,000. $100,000, should a judge order the people who did the damage to pay the bill? I'd say yes. You can vote any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let me go to your phone calls now. And if you want to join the conversation, it's 866-439-5277. Reed, what's on your mind? And thanks for listening.
Hey, Lars. Good to talk to you. So you were talking earlier about that kid that's having to pay back for starting that fire.
Yep.
And I thought this way back when, in addition to him paying, you know, what he has to pay monetarily, I always thought they ought to make that kid plant trees for the rest of his life.
You know, it's an interesting idea. Wouldn't it run up against the Constitution that says you can't create debtors' prisons in America? Because you'd essentially you'd be sentencing him to lifetime servitude, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, and but I mean, maybe that's the way we ought to go.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to get a bunch of trees planted, regardless of how much money he pays.
Yeah, the only thing is, I don't know whether or not you could make that. If you threw that kind of thing at him, said you're planting trees for the rest of your life, I have a feeling he'd be a quick trip to court with an attorney who'd say this isn't constitutional and you can't do this. Now, he has been. Do you know how much they ordered him to pay?
No, I don't.
Okay, so this, just so people know, this is the fire that started. It'll be 7 years this September. It started on September 2nd. It took almost 3 months till almost the end of November before the fire was 100% contained. It nearly burned the town of Cascade Locks. It burned tens of thousands of acres. And the judge ordered that he pay $37 million. Now, I have a feeling he's only paid a fraction of that back, unless he's got a very, very good job. But at least he's been ordered to pay. And as I understand it, I'd love to talk to the young man someday, because if he sticks at it and pays some portion of that money, he's not going to pay a large fraction of $37 million unless he wins the lottery, that, he's at least doing what he can do to pay back. But when you have a bunch of hooligans take over the University of Washington campus or the PSU building, the Miller Library, and you do hundreds of thousands of dollars of damage, the very least a judge could do is tell those who were charged in that case, you have to pay some portion, if not all, of that money. And if you're not willing to pay it back, then guess what? You can sit in jail for a while and be in contempt of court. Thanks so much, Reed. I appreciate that. By the way, I want to mention a couple of things. I got I was talking about Tualatin Middle School the other day and some of the crazy political stuff that's going on there. And I heard from a father. I've left the name off of this one. Lars, my daughter goes to Tualatin. Ms. Cosmala, I mentioned her on the air, is the principal of the school. The entire front office is decorated with gay pride everything. My daughter and her friends informed me that one of her teachers forces them to watch CNN almost every single day. And another one of her teachers on a daily basis has been comparing Donald Trump to Hitler in the classroom, even if the kids argue back. She pushes her own political agenda on our 6th through 8th graders. I'm not sure what to do about it because I don't want them to take it out on my 8th grade daughter. Thank you very much. Well, as I said, I've left the father's name off. But that's a problem that people are up against right now. The public schools are indoctrinating their kids, and there's almost no way to stop it. Let's go to Chris. Hey, Chris, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Love your show.
Thank you.
Longtime listener, Clark County Republican PCO. I've got an angle for you on getting folks to pay for the damages, like at PSU or UW. These groups are funded by Students for Justice in Palestine, any number of Democrat donor mainly organizations. Why don't we do some good old-fashioned police work, squeeze the people that are arrested, and have them finger their funded backers and sue them for the damages?
I think it'd be good if, and I know, even though I'm not a lawyer, I've talked to enough lawyers about ideas like this over the years, you'd have to show that whoever gave the money said, I'm giving you this money and I want you to go out and commit crimes with it, or I want you to take over a building. And if you can't make that connection, the donor to that group says, oh, yeah, I believe in justice for Palestine, but I didn't ask anybody to break the law. And at that point, they're out from under it. There's got to be some kind of connection there. Now, if you can prove that the person who gave the money said, I'm paying you, go out and do these illegal things, even if it was just go out and do some damage to the campus, you might be able to hold them responsible. Otherwise, we'd both get tossed out of court on our ears for that kind of stunt. But I appreciate your call. Chris, thank you very much. It's a Tuesday. It's the Pacific Northwest, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the pitch over?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. I got to be honest with you. I want public education to work well. It does not work well right now. And every time I hear a politician say, we've got to keep our fine public schools, they're not fine. About 20% of the kids drop out. Of the 80% that remains behind, about half of them, which means a net 40%, are adequate in math, reading, science, or anything else. And the other 40% are failures. Not the kids themselves, but the system has failed to educate them. And yet in both Oregon and Washington, we see crazy decisions made and gigantic amounts of money spent on public education. And then just recently, and I talked about it, the Seattle Public Schools said, we got to close 20 of our elementary schools. And I thought, well, it's about time. I mean, they run the buildings about two-thirds full. And if you think about it this way, that means they're spending a gigantic amount of money maintaining empty buildings instead of taking those same dollars, resources, and spending them on actually educating the kids. So I saw that Lee Finner wrote about that, not along the lines I did it, but director of the Center for Education at Washington Policy. So I'm glad to welcome her back. Lee, good to have you.
Oh, great to be with you again, Lars. Thank you.
I want to know what you think of this, because I saw, and I have to call them out, a bunch of selfish parents saying, we'd rather have you run the elementary school in our neighborhood at two-thirds full, and all these other schools two-thirds full, because if you close the school in the neighborhood, we may have to take our kid farther to get to an elementary school, and it might hurt our property values, and a bunch of other, I think, fairly self-centered points of view, as opposed to take the resources and spend them on actually educating the kids. Am I wrong about that?
Well, I would look at it from the perspective of the needs of the individual child and who is speaking for which interest. And I think I'm much more prone to being sympathetic to the parents who are seeing a local public school close because of any wrongdoing of their own. They're spending, you know, the taxpayers are providing $23,500 per student to educate each child in Seattle Public Schools. And the reason why the district is pushing this effort to close the less well-attended schools, is because they've grossly mismanaged the budget. They have grossly mismanaged this budget. They have known that enrollment has been dropping for some time. Remember, some of their seats were backfilled. Empty seats were funded by the state, right, over the last few years. They got extra money from the federal government, and now that money has run out. And in the fall of 2022, there was a teacher strike in the Seattle Public Schools. Right as schools were reopening from COVID, the teachers union called a strike, kept the schools closed for 5 days, and after the 5 days, lo and behold, what happened? A contract giving the teachers a 7% increase and other employees a 4% increase, and that is what has driven this effort to close these smaller schools in the district. So my sympathies are not with the district, you know, central office that has millions of dollars to follow enrollment trends and write budgets and make strategic plans for the district. They have mismanaged the $1.17 billion they get to educate the children in Seattle. And so our suggestion is that the parents seize control of the parents whose schools are now being threatened to close. These are community schools. People love their neighborhood schools. They may have bought a house to be close to that school, and now they're seeing the district doesn't care about their kids' education, and they're closing this school. So we suggest that they apply to the state to open a charter school. But this could be done. You know, parents could get together and apply to the state. They'd have to tweak the law to allow new charter schools to be open. But we have a commission in place right now in the state that would, that takes, you know, was taking applications for new charter schools. We only had 18 in a system that we expected to get 40. So there are 20 slots available. This would be a fine thing for these families to do, is to convert their public, elementary school to a charter school. They could then be independent of this district and control what they teach the kids.
I think that's a great idea. Can I, let me throw another idea at you, because I'll tell you, Lee, it does bug me, though, that the schools in Seattle Public, and I think Portland Public is about the same, most of the districts are, as they lose kids, they have buildings that are one-third empty. Why don't we make use of that space? And why don't we make education use of that space and say, if you want to open a charter school, most charter schools, correct me if I'm wrong, are sitting in rented private space somewhere, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Now, and what if you said, go ahead.
Yeah, no, exactly to your point. These empty buildings that these districts have should be given over to charter schools so they don't have to pay rent with their operating funding. That's completely unfair. So here we have actually the market, the choices of parents is to send their children to these charter schools. During COVID, the charter school enrollment swelled in Washington State because parents see that they're independently run, they're much smaller and more nurturing, they encourage the children to work hard in school, they don't have discipline problems like the traditional public schools, et cetera, et cetera. And so parents want charter schools, yet the system fights them. Even though they have empty buildings, they don't hand them over to the charter schools, which they clearly should. That would be the right thing to do in this situation, is to let the public charter schools have access to the public school buildings that are empty because of falling enrollment. And then you'd have some operation of the market in this way.
I agree with you. And because, Lee, it kills me the idea that we're maintaining empty space. You know that there are a lot of private companies that after the pandemic said, well, if half our staff can work from home, we don't have to rent half the space we're renting right now or owning right now.
Yeah.
The only other thing is, I don't assume the buildings will be empty, but if you have a school building that's, say, 60% full, which sounds like it's typical throughout the district, let's give the other 35 or 40% to a charter school to co-locate in the same building, in the same neighborhood. And if people say, well, what if a whole bunch of the kids decide the charter school is doing a better job, you know, or the parents, than the traditional elementary school is?
Yeah.
Well, then we'll take over more of the building. And you could have... It's like driving up to a street corner and you look, I got McDonald's over here. I got Taco Bell over there. I've got Kentucky Fried over there. I can choose, and I get a chance to choose easily, move my kid down the hall from the K-12 failing public school to the charter school that's in the same building in the same neighborhood. And like you said, not having to pay rent to a private landlord.
Yes, absolutely. This is happening. Actually, you must know this very good idea that doing in New York City. Okay, and they have co-located charter schools in the same building with a traditional school. And you know what some of the researchers have found? That the presence of a charter school within the building drives up the performance of the traditional school in the same building. Ha, what a surprise.
Yeah, what a shocker that competition actually produces excellence. Why, if only the folks in the NBA and Major League Baseball and basketball and everything else, what if they could figure out that competition drives excellence and it actually drives a lower cost and a higher quality of goods? That's Lee Finna, who's director of the Center for Education at Washington Policy. Lee, thanks very much. I appreciate you coming on. Coming up in a moment, I'll get to more of your phone calls and your emails. And I got to tell you about the fact that Americans are being lied to over and over again when it comes to the death toll in Gaza. We'll get to that coming up next on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Nixon was wrong about a lot of things, but he's right about this.
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
What say you, Joe Biden? This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I know that the war in Gaza against the Hamas terrorists troubles a lot of people. It troubles me that the terrorists got away with what they did last year in Israel. It troubles me that too many Americans, especially younger Americans, are siding with the terrorists instead of the good guys. But I want to point something out to you. A lot of what they believe is driven by the news that you've heard over the last few months. And now we find out that a lot of the numbers, including the numbers of deaths of women and children, have been vastly exaggerated. And how do I know that? Because the people doing the exaggeration have now admitted, well, it's actually not so many people. Exaggerated by more than 10,000. Let me get into the details of that in a moment, because it does drive American policy and may, in fact, affect this year's presidential election, as you can well imagine. Let me get to that in a moment. First, welcome to the program. Glad to get your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we love naysayers. Call the show and disagree with me. You go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And vote in our poll on X. You'll find the question every day, a brand new one, at Lars Larson Show on X, formerly Twitter, and also at LarsLarson.com. First, though, I want to go to Jesse. Hey, Jesse, welcome to the program. What's on your mind? Jesse?
This flew in from Philadelphia. Yeah, can you hear me, Lars?
I can now. You dropped out for a second.
Sorry about that. I just flew in last night from Philadelphia. Me and a couple buddies went out there to see the Trump rally in Wildwood, New Jersey.
Yeah.
It was awesome. He said so many terrific and brilliant things, but there was one I wanted to highlight, because I thought it was just so much more astute than anything else he said. Even more astute and sentimental than his touching tribute to Hannibal Lecter.
I thought that was hilarious.
The fact that he doesn't... Oh, it was hysterical. Yeah, I love the fact that he won't give a dime to any school district that has vaccine mandates.
Yep.
I can't wait till next school year when my kids come back with mumps, measles, and polio. That's going to be awesome, won't it?
Well, now, hold on a second, Jesse. Maybe I'm misunderstanding you. Should it be the government's job to decide what your kids are vaccinated for, or you, the parent?
It should be, it was some things, the government, but that's okay.
Well, hold on. I want to get clarification on this, Jesse. Jesse, if your kids, I was vaccinated for measles when I was 9 years old. I'm still immune according to the tests they've done on me in the last couple of years. My mom decided that I should have the measles vaccine. My mom and dad decided whether or not I had the DPT and all the other, I can't remember the whole alphabet soup, but it sounds like you believe the government should decide which shots your kids are forced to take and which, and that the parents should have nothing to say about it. Am I wrong about that?
I think it'll be great if other kids give my kid a horrible disease. That'll
How
be
can
fantastic.
Your kid get the horrible disease
you,
if you vaccinate
Trump.
Your child? Are you telling me you're going to deny your child vaccination that you believe in?
No.
Well, you just said your kid's going to get measles. How's your kid going to get measles if you, the dad, or maybe the mom, or both of you decide that your kid should be vaccinated? How will they catch that disease if you've decided that they should be vaccinated?
Hey, how come President Trump never...
Yeah, you changed the subject, Jesse. That's a cowardly move. We don't take cowardly moves. I ask you a question. How come this and how come that? I can smell a sandbag. I just decided to have a little bit of fun with you because this is absolutely crazy. Why? My kids won't have any vaccine that I decide. No, that's all up to the government. Okay, Jesse, thanks very much. I know it's a campaign year, so I know I'm going to get some seminar callers. Jesse is probably the best one so far this week, but still a weak premise. Why, if I send my kids to school and I decide that they should be vaccinated, but the government does not decide to force them to be vaccinated, why, then they won't be vaccinated. Because, Jesse, if you're of that mindset, you believe that parents have nothing to say about your kids. If you actually have any kids, I suspect you may not, and thank God for that. But You're suggesting that if the government doesn't tell you to do something, that you won't do it. Are you really that simple-minded? If the government doesn't tell you to go to the restroom and wash your hands when you're done, do you not wash your hands? Well, the government didn't tell me to do it. Why would I do it if the government didn't order me to do it? Jesse, most of us, in fact, most of the people who listen to this show, are more sensible than that. We know the proper things to do to run our own lives. We don't like the government acting like a nanny. Now, if you want a nanny state, Jesse, you can find lots of nanny state governments on planet Earth. I mean, there are lots of countries like China that'll be happy to tell you everything about how you are to conduct yourself every single day of the week. In fact, in China, they'll give you a social credit score, Jesse. And if they decide that you're saying the wrong things or doing the wrong things, why, they'll tell you you're no longer able to buy anything at the store. You're no longer able to travel on a train or an airplane. You want that kind of government, Jesse? I'm sure the People's Republic would be glad to take you. Most people are trying to get out of that country, though. Word to the wise, you might not want to go there. But if that's the kind of government you want, you can find it on planet Earth. I hope we never find that kind of government here in America. Anyway, glad to get your calls. I want to tell you about these numbers in Gaza, because this is why it's so very, very essential. American policy is determined to a large extent by numbers. So if you say, why, tens of thousands of women and children are being killed in Gaza, so Joe Biden should not give bombs and bullets to the Israeli Defense Forces. Do you remember last October when there was a big blast at one of the hospitals? It's called the Al-Hali Hospital in northern Gaza. And of course, Gaza, run by the Hamas terrorists, announced that 500 civilians had died because of an Israeli airstrike. And then we found out it was a big fat lie, because there was a crater. The crater was in the parking lot of the hospital. The actual death toll was much lower. And it turns out it wasn't the Israelis at all. It was a terrorist rocket that Hamas tried to launch. The rocket failed to launch, fell back, blew up, and killed a lot of people in the hospital. But it was wrong numbers and wrong source. Well, it turns out the corrupt United Nations has been lying for months about the number of women and children killed in Gaza. Now, you might ask, Lars, how do you know they're lying? It's much to call them liars. Well, I know they're lying because the United Nations fessed up to the lie this week. And then they offered up absolutely no explanation whatsoever why their numbers suddenly dropped from 25,000 killed, that's women and children, to just 11,000 killed. And when they asked a UN spokesman, a guy named Farhan Haq, weird name, but whatever, he was asked, how do you explain dropping the number from 25,000 dead to 11,000 fewer than that? And here's the quote, in the fog of war, it's difficult to come up with numbers. Apparently, it's possible to come up with really big numbers, and then later on, you have to admit, actually, that's not the number who died. And you know why they're finally admitting it? I'll cite some of the reporting of National Review. Fact is, they were telling people that tens of thousands of women and children had died. But the problem is the number of people treated at hospitals and the gender of the corpses that were located didn't match up with those numbers, and they were going to get caught. So they decided to fess up, and the UN confessed that it was lying. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Control explained.
Want to stop drunk drivers from killing sober drivers? Ban sober drivers. That's how gun control works.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. Always glad to get your phone calls and emails. You know, there's a part of me that suspects that if Joe Biden wasn't so demented, I almost would wonder whether or not the guy is running around saying, how crazy can I get in a speech or a statement before people will finally call me out? So you have this thing where Joe Biden runs around saying, hey, crime is dropping everywhere in America, without taking a look at, I wonder if it's because crime's actually down. Doesn't seem to be. Or is it because there are a whole bunch of police agencies that aren't reporting the numbers anymore like they were just a few years ago? Let's put that notion to Lance LaRusso, who's attorney, former law enforcement, and author of several law enforcement books, most recently, most notably, Blue News. Lance, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Like I said, if I thought Joe Biden was actually could actually put two thoughts together, I think maybe he's just seeing how crazy can I get before somebody's actually going to call me on this. But he runs around saying we should celebrate the fact that crime is dropping all the way across the United States. And yet, is that true?
Well, clearly, first of all, it's not true. But second, it reminds me of a phrase that a friend of mine came up with who was in charge of a crime commission. He said, you know, do you want to do something about crime or do you want to do something about crime statistics? And I thought that was a great line. But, you know, and this also reminds me of a city or a county, actually, in Georgia, rural Georgia, that had like it was some insane thing. I'll probably get the number like a 5,000% increase in crime in a 12-month period. And everybody said, oh, what's going on there? And people were studying it. They got a 911 system. So people were reporting crime, and it was easier to do so. So it's, you know, I think you have a lot of factors here. I think one of the factors is that people are not reporting crimes like car break-ins or thefts from houses and sometimes even burglaries in some neighborhoods because they know nothing's going to be done about it. And I've talked to people who have had their cars broken into, and they're, I'm not even going to sit around to wait for the police. It's going to take them an hour to get here. When they get here, they're going to take a report, or they're going to take a report over the phone, and they're not going to catch the person. Think about credit card fraud. How many times have you heard of somebody getting ripped off on their credit card, and they just report it to the insurance, they report it to the credit card company, and they move on? So there's a certain factor here, and yes, it has to do with the officers that are responding. It has to do with the fact that you have the same people committing the crimes over and over again. But it's reflective, I think, a lot of the hopelessness of a lot of people in inner cities. They're not even bothering to report it.
Well, and in fact, Lance, that's the thing I'm concerned about, because it suggests it could get worse while the numbers get better. Because as people begin to see, I mean, some of this is we learn by experience. So we say, well, my neighbor's house got broken into. He called the cops. Nothing happened. So, you know, he's not reporting any more of them if it ever happens again. So then I'm not going to do it, because people begin to figure out if nothing much is going to happen and there's no reason to actually file a report unless you want to, say, file an insurance claim and a police report is required, you're just not going to report it. And that phenomena will grow, won't it?
It will. And crime prevention and crime suppression, which are two issues that are bantered about a lot, and I think politicians really don't understand it, but crime prevention and crime suppression are reliant upon people not being tolerant of crime. The person who is driving a stolen vehicle, who gets stopped, and that car is returned to the owner because the police were notified in a timely manner, that's crime suppression and it's crime prevention, because it gets out. That person knows they were driving a car, they got arrested, that person goes to jail, and they don't commit the crime again. But when people see folks walking around committing crimes, selling drugs on the street, and they recognize that there's some sort of hopelessness, they lose their vigilance to get law enforcement and the criminal justice system involved to effect a change. And I think that's what you're seeing in a lot of these communities. It's a lack of vigilance that's just based on, I don't want to say hopelessness. Hopefully it's not gotten that bad yet, but just a lack of belief that there will be a change affected by their efforts. So they go about their business and try to live their lives ignoring what they see.
And by the way, Lance, most of what we've talked about so far is what we call property crime. So your house is broken into, your car is stolen, credit card fraud. Those are property crimes. But this can go to person crimes as well. I saw one just recently, earlier this year. There was a woman in my neck of the woods who was sexually assaulted as she got off of a transit train. And the man was charged with a serious offense, a felony. And then he shows up in front of a judge. And the judge says, well, it really wasn't that bad. It was a female judge, believe it or not, and a female victim, and she knocked it down to a misdemeanor. And I looked at that, and I thought, number one, you know, can you imagine being the woman who's physically assaulted by this guy, sexually assaulted by this guy? I kind of hesitate to go into the details, but, you know, but the judge said, nah, not that big a deal. I'm knocking it down to a misdemeanor. The victim takes a message from that, but the perpetrator does, too. And he says, yeah, I did this and I got nothing, or I got next to nothing. That word will get around the criminal community too, won't it?
Oh, of course. And then you have another issue, and I've never seen a single study that did not support the notion that rape and sexual assaults are underreported. They are underreported as a historical fact. So if you have situations like that, and let's look at a transit systems, New York City, we know that we're having people thrown in front of trains and we're having people robbed on the platforms. It's axiomatic that not everybody who is a victim of a crime is going to stop what they're doing and wait for a law enforcement officer to come by to report the crime.
Yep.
There's a lot of people who are just going to move on and say, well, you know, I'd rather just remain private about it. I'd rather remain quiet. Or I don't want to be on the news and be the person that's tracked, you know, for reporting this crime. Now, the other issue that really becomes a problem is when people are released from jail on these no bail issues. I've talked to officers who grew up in inner city communities, and they very, very concerned about this, saying, you know, when the bad guy was taken off the street and you didn't see him again until he went to trial, he either got found guilty or not guilty, the community had faith that the police were going to do something. And in those inner cities, in those bad communities, in communities that have a lot of crime, law enforcement can't be successful without the cooperation of the residents. So if they start losing faith that the system will work because they identify a bad guy and the bad guy's back out on the street that afternoon, they're just going to stop reporting the crime. It doesn't mean they're not being burglarized and robbed and other things.
And maybe even a sense of self-preservation. If you know, if I report this guy, he's going to take a trip to jail. He'll be out in a day or two at most, maybe a few hours. And he's going to be back in my community. And whether the person overtly tampers with a witness or not, you know that the guy is in your community. And you see him back on the streets and you think, is this putting me at greater risk?
Oh, of course. And that is the survival nature that you have to have when you have no other options and you're living in a crime-ridden community. And that's a natural outgrowth of not holding people responsible. It is just absolutely amazing to me that anyone thinks that some of these reforms that we have in place are going to do anything about crime. But like I said to start with, they probably will do something about crime statistics, which is what people are going to run for office based on.
Well, it'd be interesting to see whether reporters, I mean, they seem to have turned on Biden to some extent. They were carrying water for him for a long time on all kinds of things, electric vehicles or energy policy or foreign policy. And now they seem to be questioning him a lot more. I'll be interested to see whether or not the major media, when the next time the president goes out and gives one of these speeches in which he says, oh, we've got a big drop in violent crime, if the reporter says, well, do I carry water for Joe this time, or do I actually, and tell my audience, oh, that crime you're seeing in your neighborhood is not actually happening? Or should I actually fact check him and tell my audience the truth? I'm hoping they choose the latter. That's Lance LaRusso, attorney and former law enforcement officer, and the author of two great books on law enforcement, including Blue News. The proceeds from those books go to police charities to benefit the fallen among the blue. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Show.
Welcome back to the program. I had meant to mention this yesterday, and I've got to fault my friends at Coin TV, that's the CBS affiliate in Portland, but Coin News ran this story that seemed like it was written right out of a press release for Amtrak. Now, I'm a big fan of Amtrak. I am not. It loses over $1 billion every year. It has never really broken even. It's a government agency. And it makes no sense to operate it the way they're operating it. But a friend of mine, John Lee, pointed out that Coin had run a story, and they said it this way. I'll quote directly from the story. The Amtrak Cascades rail service, that's Portland to Seattle, experienced its highest ridership in its 30-year history in March, month of March, with 14,200 riders, a 57% increase over last month. or last year, March of 23. And he looked at it, and he and I do the same kind of thing. We take the numbers and we look at them and say, what does this mean? Well, there are 12 trains a day between Seattle and Portland. That means when you divide out the passengers per day in the month of March, it works out to 38 passengers on each one of those trains if they were all averaged out at the same number. So 14,000 in a month, that's about less than 500 a day divided by 12 trains is 38 passengers. You could have carried the same passengers on a bus that went from Seattle to Portland. And you say, and that's the highest ridership they've ever achieved. And by the way, total ticket revenue pays maybe 60% of the cost of running the train. And they say, and this is the funniest part, on-time performance remains below their goal of 88%. So Amtrak's goal is to get to the point where they're on time 88% of the time. They're on time about 50% of the time right now. I mean, this is a failing enterprise if there ever was one. To say we're going to lose $1 billion a year, we're going to be on time 50% of the time, and we're going to run, by the way, the average passenger locomotive costs between $5 and $6 million. That's for a passenger locomotive, not a freight locomotive. And the average train car, depending on how it's equipped, runs $1 to $3 million each. So take the lower end of those numbers. You're going to take a $6 million vehicle. You're going to run it from Portland to Seattle with 38 people on board on a $6 million vehicle instead of running a $600,000 bus between Seattle and Portland. And you're saying, and this is the best we've done in 30 years. Absolutely pathetic. Let's go to Girish, who's listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Girish, welcome to the program.
Hey, Lars, thanks for taking my call. I'm a regular listener of your show, and like just like many of your other listeners, I admire your show for the honestly provocative theme that you keep time and time again, and the clarity and the command over the language and other things. So I just want to compliment
you
quickly on that. But today when I was listening to your show, there's one thing that just caught me off guard, and I just thought I'll call you and let you know what I feel. There was this number from the Israel-Hamas war that was initially 26,000-something, and then the UN, you said, corrected it, probably initially lied about it and then corrected it, and whatever, it came down to 11,000.
They dropped up by 11,000 from 26,000 to about 14,000. So the UN had been saying 26,000 women and children had died, and presumptively they're not members of Hamas. The males, it's a coin toss. But when they say, oh, we told you it was 26,000, it was actually only 14,000. That's a gigantic difference, isn't it?
That is. It is a gigantic difference, but I beg to differ with you with the usage of the word just 14,000 women and children. We are talking about completely innocent women and children dying in war who has nothing to do with any of the conflict happening here. And for any empathetic listener listening to this, word just doesn't rhyme
with itself. Can I tell you why I say that, Girish? In 2006, the last time there were elections in Gaza, last time Hamas terrorists allowed elections, they were elected as the government. So the people of that area, that little strip of land, elected a terrorist group as their government. They now allow that government to that terrorist group to operate as their government. And even today, the polls done by Pew and other groups of Gaza say 70% of the population support what was done on October 7th. When you say these people had nothing to do with it, these people chose Hamas as its government. They allow them to operate. They provide them with cover, and they provide them with human shields. So what should we say about a group of people who say...
You definitely know much better than me on this one, right? How these things happen. They are uneducated, poor. They just get bought out for some of these things, right? It's not that they intentionally want to allow some of these criminal activities to go
on. Were the German people of Nazi Germany innocent as long as they weren't in the leadership?
Sorry, say that again.
Were the German people from 1940 to 45 innocent of what was done by the leadership of their country?
No, not at all.
They weren't?
Yeah.
Okay, so are the people of Gaza innocent of what their leadership is doing?
I agree your point, right? I mean, but there are children. Like, think about children, right? That doesn't add to your point. The children has nothing to do with this. They didn't own, they didn't do anything.
And I agree with you there, but how should we go after a terrorist organization that chooses to shelter among children and women? Should we just leave them alone and let them do what they will?
That's the nuance of war. I mean, that's the whole point of being able to wage a war ethically and in the right way, right? There are many different ways to wage war.
Well, the choice is either go after them or let them be because they use human shields. And I think both are bad moral choices.
The Lars Larson.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call it crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you here on the Radio Northwest Network. Our poll on X today. Should a judge order the occupiers who damage college campuses to pay the bill? I cited a couple of examples. University of Washington, where they say their crews can't even keep up with all the graffiti vandalism. They paint it over one day and it's back the next day. Now, that's smaller potatoes than what's going on at PSU. PSU had its Miller Library taken over by a bunch of pro-Hamas terrorist protesters, and they did. Now the estimate is $750,000 to $875,000 in damage. And I simply said, should a judge order the occupiers who did that damage to pay the bill? I'd answer yes. You can answer any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show on X, also on our website, LarsLarson.com, and always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, on the phone with me right now is my talk colleague from our Seattle affiliate, KVI, Ari Hoffman. Ari, how are you?
I'm great, buddy. How you doing?
I'd be doing better if there weren't so many crazy... I mean, actually, you and I like crazy things in the news because it's kind of our bread and butter. But when you say, and you had these two exclusives for Postmillennial, a University of Washington Gaza camp ring leader has been identified as a... Is he a current Seattle columnist or former? I can't tell. His post on X seems to indicate that Aziza, and is it Junjo, is a current columnist for the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper?
He's not a current columnist. The last time he wrote for them was a while ago. But he is a current columnist for some other smaller outlets in our area, more like blog sites. And this is a guy who used to write religious articles. And looking up some of his stuff, it's just the kind of question of you could kind of sort of tell where this guy was going. I mean, I do love that he's in the pro-Hamas encampment, and he talks about in his Twitter bio about how he's pro-women's rights. Well, last time I checked, Hamas raped and brutalized and mutilated a whole bunch of women, and you're hanging out inside the encampment at the University of Washington for the people who support that kind of stuff. So let's be real about who this guy is. So the Seattle Times was very quick with a response to say, oh, he hasn't written for us since 2014, but at the same time, it does show you the state of media, whereas these are the kind of people who are writing articles in a lot of mainstream media outlets, people like this. And it's not like the war between Israel and Hamas is new. Question is, what was this guy saying back then?
Well, and not any stranger than, say, Queers for Palestine, by apparently a group of people who don't understand if they were in Gaza, they might just get tossed off the top of a tall building or a short building. The other thing was this story you had where a Washington middle school has put up replaced the flag of Israel in the hallway of that school, a public school, with the flag of Palestine, a country that doesn't actually exist. What's going on there?
Well, they didn't. It wasn't just the flag. They replaced the whole country. So apparently, and I didn't know this, April is Middle Eastern and Arab Heritage Month in the U.S. because everything gets a month or whatever it is. So they did a whole display with the Palestinian flag colors. And they do this whole display on the wall of every country in the Middle East, but instead of Israel, it says Palestine. And what's even more off-putting about this whole thing is it talks about the top languages spoken in the area, and it mentions Hebrew. And then you got to ask yourself, wait a minute, there's not a lot of Jews in these other countries, so where's that one coming from if there's no Jewish country? Palestine is not even a recognized country by anybody. If you're looking for Palestine on a map, you're going to find it somewhere between Tatooine and Narnia. It just ain't there. Because if the Palestinians, instead of voting for Hamas, had actually spent all that money on aid and built a beautiful country, they could have had something like Singapore by now with this beautiful seaside or Abu Dhabi. But instead, they decided to use it on terror tunnels and stuff. Now, when I reached out to the school, they said to me, oh, well, we're gonna clarify it so it makes clear what it is because we're doing Arab heritage. And I said, you do know that technically this fake Jewish Heritage Month that you guys have created, Jewish American Heritage Month, is May. So now you're going to have that thing up in your halls for Jewish American Heritage Month? Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And this is Kellogg Middle School. And who's driving this stuff? Is it being driven by the school board, by the superintendent, by the principal of Kellogg Middle School, or what?
It seems like it's the DEI department, and this is something that people need to worry about. You notice you saw MIT and a few other schools start nixing their DEI departments.
Yep.
And
yep.
The reason they're doing that is a lot of this anti-Semitism and hate is being blamed on. I mean, Lars, here, I put the challenge out to your audience. Can anybody name for me a single school which implemented the DEI curriculum where the grades went up? Can anybody point out to me a single school which implemented DEI where all of a sudden everybody was friendlier to each other? Can you find one school where they implemented DEI and the kids had better mental health? And the answer to that is, of course, no, because what this curriculum has done is to divide people into oppressors versus oppressed. And if you keep going that way, these kids who are immigrants from, let's say, Europe, come to the United States of America and are immediately told, well, you're a white-skinned person, so you're responsible for the evils of the world. It's absolutely nuts. So, of course, this is taking its toll, and as opposed to learning reading, writing, and arithmetic, they're being told, well, here's all the reasons you're a racist. And as if schools didn't have enough problems beforehand, you can see this in the grades. And this is why a lot of parents are also yanking their kids. We saw what happened with Seattle Public Schools recently, where Seattle Public Schools is going to have to close 20 of their elementary schools because they don't have enough students because so many people have left.
But they have $17 million to spend on budget planning. Let me ask you, because the best suggestion I've heard from people is get rid of the DEI department. Oregon has at least one large county, Clackamas, that got rid of its entire DEI department, saved them almost $1 million. But I've also seen the suggestion, and I think it's a good one, say, why don't we take the money we were wasting on DEI and apply it to, say, tutoring, and say any kid of any color or any gender or any whatever sexual preference or pronoun will get some tutoring help to get them up to speed, no matter who they are, and not have something that's race-based. I thought that was a great suggestion.
It's a great suggestion, especially when you consider the fact that they kept kids out of school for almost 2 years in Seattle during COVID, and they never did anything to make it up. They didn't extend the school day. They didn't say, hey, guys, you're going to miss your summer this year because we got to catch you up. They didn't do anything. So those kids still haven't caught up on that, and now they're going head-to-head with kids from private schools and charter schools around the country who weren't out of school that long. So that's what's going on with this, where now they have to compete with them, and they have a handicap on top of it, where now they were out of school for 2 years doing Zoom, watching Wolf of Wall Street while their teacher was trying to teach them and they weren't paying attention for 2 years.
I got one last quick one, less than a minute. Bob Ferguson, now that he's used election interference to get rid of the other two Bob Fergusons, has Bob, who wants to be governor of the state, had anything to say about the violence and the discrimination that's going on in the UW campus?
No, he was actually thrown a softball question by Chris Daniels from Como News just the other day. He could have answered that and said, of course I condemn it. It's my alma mater. It's terrible. Instead, he dodged the question. Why? Because he knows that those radicals represent his base. And without him, he has no chance of actually winning this election.
Wonderful. The courage of Bob Ferguson, who couldn't stand. By the way, take a close look, Ari, at the statute that Bob Ferguson was threatening the other Bob Fergusons with, saying, it's a felony, I'll put you in jail for 10 years. And in fact, if you read it, the other Bob Fergusons don't appear to have violated that law. Or I can't imagine the case being made. That's Ari Hoffman. His talk show follows mine on our Seattle affiliate. That's KVI. Glad to be with you on a Tuesday afternoon. Coming up in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And I got to talk about the latest public opinion polls. Joe Biden is losing big time, and we're still 6 months from the election.
talk about serious issues, but even Lars has a sense of humor.
I have a joke for you. The government in this town is excellent and uses your tax dollars efficiently.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to talk about the latest presidential poll numbers, and I frequently get people who ask, well, you don't actually believe those polls, do you? I don't view polls as definitive. The most important poll, as politicians like to say, is the one on November the 5th when Americans will vote and choose a president, or at least choose the electors whose votes will actually choose the president. But do I look at them as a way of telling which direction the wind is blowing? Is it blowing in the direction of Joe Biden, the demented current president of the United States, or is it blowing in the direction of President Trump, the finest president of the 21st century? Well, it turns out that the New York Times has a brand new poll out, and it does not look very good for Joe Biden. So even if you assume the polls are not accurate, they're off by more percentage points than the standard 3.5% or so. The poll that was done on Monday of registered voters in the six so-called swing states. And why do they call them swing states? Because in many states, you have an overwhelming number of Democrats, and you expect, well, a presidential candidate who's running as a Democrat will capture that state relatively easily. That assumption is made of places like California, even though I don't think it's always accurate, because California, when it votes on ballot measures, and it's voted on a number of them in the last decade that indicate the state's population is a whole lot more conservative than people might think if you just based it on Gavin Newsom and Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff and people like that. But if you look at the states where it's right on the middle, it's a purple state, half blue and half red, and you say, well, Trump could win that one or Joe Biden could. Now, if you believe the fraudulent results of the 2020 election, and yes, I'm going to keep on questioning what happened in that election, because since 2020, we have learned that literally hundreds of thousands of votes were counted for Joe Biden that didn't belong to him. They didn't have signatures on them. They weren't dated. They were, in many cases, ballots that had been sent out to people illegally. In the state of Wisconsin, for example, they sent out absentee ballots. And that state has a law that says you want to send an absentee ballot, you can, but the voter has to apply to get it. And they just ignored the law and did it the way they wanted to. In that poll of the six key swing states, guess what? Donald Trump leads in a couple of cases by very substantial numbers over Joe Biden. Biden leads by just 2 percentage points in Wisconsin, which you might notice is well within the margin of error. But in other states, Pennsylvania, Trump by 5. Arizona, Trump by 7. Georgia, Trump by 10. And in the state of Nevada, Trump by 12. As I said, if you believe the fraudulent results of the election in 2020, Biden won all of those states. But his margins in Arizona and Georgia and Wisconsin were narrow. If you added up all the swing states and you say, how much did Biden do better? If you believe the results, about 144,000 votes, less than 12,000 votes in the state of Georgia, for example. But the polling, for months, the polls have shown that Donald Trump is leading Joe Biden. 5 out of 6 swing states. And this is going to put, I think, the Biden administration in an absolute panic. I think his campaign is already in a panic. They know that things are not going well, which may be why a couple of weeks ago, Joe Biden finally accepted that he is going to debate Donald Trump. Although that may just widen the margin even more. Because I think all of us who've watched Joe Biden speak in the last couple of months and watched Donald Trump at things like that gigantic rally in Wildwood, New Jersey over the weekend, a solid blue, as one commentator put it, Arctic blue state of New Jersey. It's so blue they can't see daylight. And yet Donald Trump gets 90 to 100,000 people to show up in person for a gigantic outdoor rally. And it went on for hours and he did very, very well. And you watch a man speak like that. I'm an admirer of Donald Trump, so you can take that into account as well. But you watch the way that Trump is able to handle the issues, is able to meet challenges, that I don't think that Donald Trump will have any problem answering any question that is put to him. I wonder whether or not Joe Biden can tell you anything other than his favorite ice cream flavor. In fact, CNN's Harry Enten, who is their specialist when it comes to polling data. And remember, the Chicken Noodle News Network is not just to the left. They are far to the left. He calls the New York Times polling numbers that are coming out of those swing states, quote, an absolute disaster. Now, what does Joe Biden do? Well, he's pushing every button he can. He's going to slap new tariffs on China. He may even take some actions on the border. He's done other things. And, of course, he's trying to buy his way to an election victory in November. He'll say, I'll pay off your student loans. I'll give you some special money to put down on a house. I'll do all those things. So he's trying to buy his way with your money to a victory. Now, Enten says the numbers out of Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, well, maybe a little bit better for Joe Biden, but he says that's going to be about the only way he gets to victory. And Enten says it's advantage Donald Trump. He's not over the 270 mark just yet. 270 is the number of electoral votes that any candidate needs to be able to win the presidency. But the fact is that the pollsters on the right, the ones on Donald Trump's side of the aisle, they're showing that the polls have typically underestimated Donald Trump's support. Now, when you say if the polls usually underestimate Trump's support and he's up by 12 in Nevada and 10 in Georgia and 7 in Arizona and 5 in Michigan and 3 in Pennsylvania, then it could be even bigger. I mean, absolutely bigger. And then you see what Joe Biden is trying to do. He's going to lie to the American public. He's going to tell you, as he told an audience about a week ago, he'll say, well, you know, inflation's not that bad. People have the money. They just don't want to spend it. I mean, the idea that a president could actually say such a thing, to say groceries are up 30 to 40%, gasoline's up 40%, mortgage rates have tripled from 2.65 to well over 7 percentage points. It's crippling just about every aspect of your life. Food, fuel, and even the house you live in. So what does Joe Biden's campaign do? They put up a brand new ad that shows Donald Trump downplaying the COVID-19 pandemic. I think the flaw there is Joe Biden thinks he's disparaging Donald Trump. An awful lot of Americans have now looked back at 2020 and said the way that we responded to the pandemic as a nation was a gigantic mistake. And the states like Florida that decided to handle it differently was the right way to do it. So when Joe Biden says Donald Trump downplayed the pandemic, well, that's actually to his credit. And then get this. Joe Biden, the other day at his speech, said why Donald Trump lost a million people to COVID during his last year of his presidency. Well, the CDC says it was one-third that number, 360,000. Still a lot of people. But Joe can't run around America forever tripling numbers and doubling other numbers and telling people crime is down when it's up. Inflation is up when it's, and Joe Biden will say it's down. Everything is fine. Don't worry about it. People have got the money when people are running up gigantic credit card bills just trying to stay even and then lie about that. Here's a stat for you. And if you don't believe me, check with the government's agencies, the CDC. More Americans died from COVID under Joe Biden than during Donald Trump. And he had to handle that first year of the pandemic. Just consider that when you see that next Joe Biden ad. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
What a vegan actually is?
They say cows are bad for the environment because all they do is eat plants and fart, just like vegans.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You know, we've talked about crime and the most serious kinds of crime, you know, person crime, rape, murder, assault, things like that. But I guess it kind of surprises me that to some extent, America's big downtowns are being torn apart by some of the most pedestrian kinds of crime. It's still crime, but things like shoplifting and theft are driving some America downtowns into a state I'm not sure they can recover from. So I thought I'd talk to Cully Stimson, who's written about this recently. He's a senior legal fellow for Heritage, manager at the National Security Law Program, and the co-author with Zach Smith of Rogue Prosecutors, How Radical Soros Lawyers Are Destroying America's Communities. Cully, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
I mean, from a distance, I've been watching as big cities are losing some of the core tenants of downtown, the retail stores and everything else that, other than the lawyers' offices and the accountants' offices, are the things that drive most big downtowns. And you wrote about San Francisco recently in the Daily Signal. Would you mind telling my audience?
Happy to. So we spent a day in San Francisco, a place where I've been many times, with a documentary filmmaker, and went to the Tenderloin District, Pier 14, where the murder took place by an illegal alien. We went to the Westfield Shopping Center. We went to the In-N-Out Burger in Oakland, which is the first one that's been closed because of rampant crime. And we have a societal rot series on the Daily Signal and other Heritage platforms videotaping and showing you how rampant crime and a pro-criminal policy suite of things that these city councils and rogue prosecutors have done that have eviscerated the inner heartbeat of cities. So, like, for example, you know what's going on in Portland because that's your backyard.
Yep.
But in San Francisco, Union Square is sort of the center of town. And on that square, that, you know, 2-acre, 3-acre block is Macy's, the iconic huge Macy's that takes up one quarter of the block. Macy's is closing. The Westfield Shopping Center in downtown San Francisco, where Nordstrom's closed. So we take you with a video camera through those places and show how the places have been hollowed out because they're pro-criminal. And that just doesn't deprive the cities of tax revenue. It deprives the city of jobs, places to live, work, and play. And it's just become a dystopian city. And a lot of cities in the country have become that way.
I don't know if you've done the hotels yet, but Cully, I remember about a year ago we were talking about the plight of some of the bigger hotels in downtown San Francisco as a, you know, poster child for other cities that are going through similar. And they said literally the companies running them were saying, we can't make the bottom line. We're, you know, they were at the point where they, I think they were going to have to hand the keys back to the bank. And when that happens, other bad things get transmitted up the chain because a bank that has to take back a hotel that can't be paid for, and they've now got the property and nobody wants to buy it because it's in the middle of one of these zones of, you know, of rot, as you put it, you know, that can have the kind of effects that won't be, they won't be able to bring it back to what it was for at least a considerable period of time.
That's correct. And look, societal rot is a choice. You either choose, as a policy matter, by the stakeholders in the city to enforce the law fairly and but firmly, or don't. And if you don't, you're killing the inner city, the heartbeat of your town. So, for example, on your hotel point, I was in New Orleans recently at a major hotel right on the waterfront near, you know, the French Quarter, and they handed you a map when you checked in and said, these are the areas you should feel relatively safe walking in. And then the map had a red area and said, don't go anywhere outside in this red area. So they are literally telling you, you're taking your life at your own hands if you go into this area. No go zones, basically. And so it's sad, but it's a choice. Societal rot is a choice. And when you check out these videos, because this is not your typical Heritage blog, this is a video little mini series, one each day this week, you'll see the human depravity and decrepit conditions that people are living on the street in San Francisco. And this is replicated in other cities. And, of course, you've seen it downtown Portland.
Yep. And by the way, Cully, look, I want cities to prosper. But having said that, to what extent should we say, well, the people who live in this city voted for these people? They voted for the city council, the county commission, the rogue prosecutor, and maybe they were guided wrongly by monies from George Soros and other people, but they chose these policies and now they get the result. Is it unfair to look at it that way?
I think it's probably a little harsh, only when you consider the fact that about 10% of the registered people, the registered voters, actually participate. So 90% of the people, although they had the opportunity to vote, didn't vote. And then once these feel-good terms and happy terms that they candidates run on turn out to be a nightmare, they're stuck with these people for 2, 3, 4 years. And so, yeah, on the one hand, it's, you know, let the buyer beware. But on the other hand, this is not what they signed up for. That's why the voters in San Francisco booted Chesa Boudin from the DA's office, why the voters in Baltimore booted Marilyn Mosby, why there's pushback against these city councils. Notice there's no talk of defunding the police right now by these city leaders because they know it's toxic.
It's
bad.
When you mentioned a choice, but let me put it this way. There was a point, and if I go back long enough to say Bill Clinton, he walked into office and said, okay, we're going to have ongoing deficits for a while. And then he was pushed to change course. And he pretty sizably changed course in the early 90s before his second term. There's that choice as well. And yet, I don't know if reporters have forgotten to go to some of these people and say to Chesa Boudin, who I didn't like when he was elected, I didn't like the idea of a son of terrorists being in charge of law enforcement for a major city, which had previously been under Kamala Harris as well at one point. But if you say those people could make a choice to change mid-course if they wanted to and if they got enough pressure from the people around them. And yet, can you name a single one of these apparatchiks who's been in this position, seeing that the policies are disasters, and said, you know, we need to course correct here?
No. They just double down on stupid. And look at George Gascon. It was the DA in San Francisco for years. He was succeeded by Chesa Boudin. He slithered down the coast to L.A., where he's the DA now. He survived two recall elections. He should have changed course because, you know, an eighth grader could have read the tea leaves on that. But in the primary earlier this year, 70% of the people who voted in the primary voted for somebody other than George Gascon. So he's looking pretty bad for the fall, but he's not reversing course. And none of these folks reverse course. And here's why, Lars. It's a quid pro quo. When you get that Soros money, you got to go by their playbook. And that's why we wrote our book and lay out all their plays in their playbook.
Yeah, because what you're saying is there used to be politicians who would say, okay, this isn't working, I'll go a different direction. And Biden's a good example of it, where, you know, he comes in, does 200 executive actions on the border, and then a giant problem erupts, and it's big enough nobody can avoid seeing it, and he starts to get a few questions saying, well, are you going to fix this with the same kind of executive actions you created with? And he says, no, I'm going to stick with this. And there seems to be an unwillingness to course correct.
Right. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is right. The difference is, you know, normal and crazy. And they're just doubling down on crazy. I mean, long are the days gone when Bill Clinton, you know, he vetoed welfare reform twice. And finally, he signed the law. And what happened? The welfare rolls dropped precipitously. The number of people having children out of wedlock went down. The economy boomed. We had a balanced budget. So he course corrected, but this crowd doesn't do that.
No, it sounds like it. That's Cully Stinson, who's the author, along with Zach Smith, of Rogue Prosecutors, How Radical Soros Lawyers Are Destroying America's Communities. We'll be back in just a moment. Cully, thanks very much. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
At least someone has a plan for illegal aliens.
Back in the White House, I will terminate every open borders policy of the Biden administration and begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my genuine pleasure to be with you on a daily basis. This segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medicine specialists, and our X poll today. Should a judge order the occupiers who did the damage to the college campuses to pay the bill? The current bill estimate as of today at Portland State University $750,000 to $875,000 in damage that was done in just a few days by the takeover at Miller Library, which the university administration refused to actually act on until the, you know, until the police finally were allowed to go in and do their job. And at the University of Washington, our friend Jay Cho says the crews on campus can't even keep up with the graffiti vandalism. Buildings get vandalized, they're repainted, and then they are immediately vandalized again the next day. Maybe it's time to go after the vandals themselves. I'm sorry about the long wait, but let me go to John. John, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network, and I apologize for the wait. What's on your mind today?
No problem. Good to talk to you, Lars. It's about that Tualatin school.
Oh.
The child, the student, and the parent are being bullied. It is my belief, and I can't give you my resume for education, but it's extensive.
Okay.
It is my belief that this teacher has not requested that they watch CNN for X number of days with expected outcomes and discussions. It's an indoctrination. The teacher should be written up by the principal, and the parent, or parents in this case, if there are two, should go and shadow their child for one day to find out what their education is.
By the way, and just so people know what John's speaking of, I got a note from a parent. I left the parent's name off. He says, my daughter goes to Tualatin. The office, front office is all decorated with gay pride, everything. My daughter and her friends are told to watch CNN almost every single day at school. Why kids are watching television news at school, I don't know. Another teacher has been on a daily basis comparing President Trump to Adolf Hitler in the classroom, even when the kids argue back, and she says, I don't know what to do. I think there has to be a way to do this. I would confront the principal and say, why is this going on, and is this appropriate? I think you're absolutely right, John. And if they say, yeah, it's fine, we're not going to do anything about it, then figure out how to file a complaint and say that your daughter's rights to a public education free from indoctrination ought to be valid, and you're going to find a way to bring in, if you have to, the Department of Justice. Although I understand with Merrick Garland there, that may be a fool's errand, but I'd try it anyway. Let's go to Kyle. Hey, Kyle, thanks for listening on KMED and the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks, Lars, for taking my call and making naysayers try to get educated from time to time, even though I think they're uneducatable sometimes.
I try.
The public schools and the shortfalls that we're talking about and the budgets that they do, and piggybacking on your last caller's comment, these parents, even the Democrat parents, need to vote for school of choice and get it, the petition signed and on the ballot, because we're sending our children to a public school that is no longer performance-based. It is strictly opinion-based. Yep. And the opinions that these teachers are spewing are also the same people that keep voting for policies that keep taking the money away that they want. They always want more money, and they keep voting for policies that drive up energy prices and inflation. And it's these people can't even do common sense in their own life, yet they're teaching our children. So school of choice has to be a thing.
You're right. And you know that there's a ballot measure underway in Oregon. They need the signatures. They've got to have them soon to put it on the ballot. And I have a feeling if it went on the ballot, the voters would vote for it in a heartbeat. And in fact, if you really love K-12 public education, meaning government-run education, you should like it as well. Kyle, is there a single part of life that is not improved by competition?
No, absolutely not. I am a small business owner. I work by myself, and I can compete because I build massive shops by myself. But I can compete with prices because I don't have overhead for employees, and that helps my business. But it also doesn't drive away other competitors either, because
nope.
We say so. Absolutely not. Competition keeps things fair. It's performance-based. And, I mean, when I was a kid 20 years ago graduating from school, teachers actually helped. Now they just want to spew their opinions. And it's their own faults, and I just don't understand why people keep trusting their kids with these opinion-based teachers.
Well, if this is happening to his daughter on a daily basis, I hope that father gives daughter permission to videotape some of this. And if you say, well, that's not right, well, hold on. It's a public school paid for by the taxpayers. And what you're doing with kids, if it comes down to abusing them, and I think indoctrination of kids to political points of view is indoctrination. I would never go out and try to tell somebody else's kids what to believe about anything. Certainly not about politics, and definitely not about personal sexual behavior. Because that kind of thing, that's the kind of thing that perverts would do to your kids. If you walked into a friend's house and sat down with his 10 or 12 year old daughter and said, hey, let me tell you some different ideas about sexuality. What do you suppose your friend would do right after he punched you in the face? Because
he should kick me in the gut right after that, too.
And push you right out the door. Because you wouldn't tolerate that from a close friend. Why would you tolerate it from a government employee?
And that's why all my kids are homeschooled, and other parents need to just get on the ballot and vote for this. If they want to keep sending their kids to public schools, that's fine. They can be seniors. But some of us still want performance-based. We want our children to succeed, not just...
Absolutely right. Kyle, thanks very much for the call. The Lars